Blog Talk Radio.
We welcome you to Missing Pages of History. As always, it's an honor and a pleasure to come in your home this evening to discuss issues and views that are having an impact on our community and our people. As always, we have our analyst and contributor of Missing Pages of History. They will be sharing their perspectives on hot topics and current events. And the reason why we do this is that we would like to speak truth to power and give you perspectives that you may never consider or will never have a chance to hear because there's a lockout against certain ideas, certain ways of analyzing events from certain communities and people. And what we want to do is change that dynamic. We want views and ideas to come from the community and come from the people. And most of the time, those views and those ideas have always been left out of our history books. So it's part of Missing Pages of History. What we want to do is fill in those missing pages as relates to our history and the contributions and the struggles that our people have contributed towards making humanity better. And to do this today, we have Emmanuel, who is a contributor and the analyst of Missing Pages of History, and he will be sharing his views, his perspectives with you in the world as relates to the current issue that's going on with jury duty and witnesses as it relates to the grand jury out of Ferguson. You know, as time goes along, we are beginning to find out more information that we didn't know before as it relates to this whole dynamic and what has taken place and what is taking place in Ferguson. And recently, the things that came out with witnesses and their participation on the jury, on the grand jury. And for the first topic and theme, we'd like to hear Mr. Emmanuel's perspective on this particular topic. And later on, we will open up our lines to our listening audience by dialing 818-337-0016 to hear your views and perspectives on the very topics and things that we will discuss today on Missing Pages. Emmanuel, as usual, welcome to Missing Pages of History.
Thank you.
Okay. And Emmanuel, as always, you always come with a perspective that's very enlightening and very interesting in terms of motivating people to think. Now, as I stated earlier in my introduction, seems like as time goes along, there are more things coming about what has really taken place in Ferguson as it relates to witnesses and the grand jury process and the prosecutor. Can you give us an update on some of the things that you have researched and you have been enlightened to in terms of some of the issues that have taken place that our people need to be aware of?
Well, in Ferguson, this outgoing process investigation by the FBI, of course, and Attorney General Holder, there are more than 200 cases now of the police shootings, brutality type things that's going on, and that's a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. But basically what has happened recently in the Brown case, where there's a civil suit being served there, and what has happened at the prosecutor came forward on the podium saying that one of the witnesses lied to the grand jury. Well, that is a open book now. How many more lied? I think it was told close to 60 witnesses. It couldn't have been 60 witnesses. So evidently he put out a bulletin saying anybody who was near or close to the incident with Officer Brown and Wilson to come forward. So a lot of people came forward. Well, on the way, they didn't get challenged because, of course, the defense of the Brown family had in the grand jury, you can't participate. So now the thing is definitely one-sided. A grand jury, most of the time, they are one-sided. Because, again, the prosecution, basically, and the district attorney picks everybody. So it's all that's all beforehand. And, of course, you're going to get likable witnesses to say what you want them to say. But lying is not one of the things that you're supposed to do. And he came on the podium and said that the witness lied. Now, the problem is, when did he know that? When did he know that he lied? So that's the problem there. So that is a offense, a jurisprudence, that is not tolerated. There can be charges brought against the prosecutor. One of them can be imprisonment. One, again, can be disbarred. So he's not above the law. They are not above the law when it comes to grand jury, because you're supposed to put the truth, even though it's one-sided, it still has to be the truth. So there is a bar. That truthness is the top of that bar, that the witness you put for the grand jury has to tell the truth. And this person did not tell the truth. Person was nowhere close around. They were two blocks out of basically where the incident happened. Impossible for that person to even be there. The only problem we have now, which is very problematic, will be when did he know that she was lying, or that he said she was lying. But when did he know this? So it's just a problem. That's the time. It's the timing. So now this makes the investigation, it absolutely becomes a big open book now. It makes the lawsuit, you would say, more prominent at being successful in suing Ferguson or the state of Missouri, whatever it's going to be, whoever they sue in there. Because, again, there's tax money involved, and they're going to win the suit case, without a doubt. But the thing now is that how are we going to take this matter in on the FBI and on the court of Mr. Holder, the Attorney General. So now you have a person that is the prosecutor who took an oath, and he knew the rules that govern witnesses when you have a grand jury, and the rules were totally violated, and he said it himself. They have him on camera, they have him on video, saying he knew that this witness lied. Now we got a problem. And how they alleviate this problem at the moment, we're going to keep you tuned into this. We're going to start to stay on top of this. I'm going to have my investigative team to really look at this real, real close and see all the things that can happen and what may happen, what has to happen. When a prosecutor knowingly know that the witness they put in front of the grand jury to persuade the grand jury saying something of this magnitude, that this young man charged him like a football player. This is on Fox News, that this young man charged him like a football player, so he defended himself by shooting him. This never happened. She was never at the incident. She's not a credible witness. So this is, and nobody's taking nothing back now. Fox News, Hannity hasn't taken nothing back. He made sure that he did what he had to do. And again, he took something that he knew. I think Hannity knew it himself. This was not true. This was not true. He took a person who was not there at all, 40 minutes away, and lied. So we're going to keep following this. We're going to stay in touch with this.
Well, you know, when you look at the Fox News and their network, they have a history a lot of time of reporting information that's not accurate. And they can get away with it a lot of time because they can say it came from a particular another party, and they're just reporting what the party told them. But the damage has been done, and many times, once the damage has been done, there seemed to be a process where no one really can persecute it. So in terms of looking at the history of prosecuting the prosecutor, what has that history been in terms of actually going at these prosecutors and finding out that they are violating the law? What have been your understanding and experience of that particular phenomenon? Do you really?
Well, they're immune from prosecuting, basically immune from that. But the thing is, when this is the law. So when this happens here, this is another asterisk that we don't read too much into, because this usually doesn't happen on a grand jury. This is highly unusual when you knew that the witness is lying. And when you call for 60 witnesses and you pick out the certain witness that you want to testify, the 60 was called. How many testified, I don't know, because it's all secret. But again, highly unusual prosecutors to be prosecuted. But this is a different incident. This is before they even started. When something happened, when it's already started, already in motion, this was not, may I say, in motion that particular moment. This was something that happened before picking a grand jury opposed to a jury trial, then the bill trial. So the prosecutor had a chance to make sure all he do everything correct. So again, when you get to a grand jury, everything has to be done correct. He didn't do everything correct. But again, if he knew the witness was lying when he put him on the stand to wait to the grand jury, then he has to account for this. So this might be one of the first case, the second or third case, I know it's not that many, that this has happened. Because the prosecution is very aware. He's very aware of these particular paragraphs in the law when you become a prosecutor. He's aware of this. I think there's five things that can happen. I know two of them that can be disbarred, and also they can serve prison time. I don't know what the other three are. But there are at least five things that can happen when this happens. And when you are a prosecutor and you violate these conditions.
Okay, we're going to wait as another case to see if justice is going to be served. But let's move along. There have been so many issues and hot topics going on this week. And I know that we're going to have to prioritize those that we think may have the greatest interest and impact on their people. And one of those issues for this week, and it's also an ongoing issue, is the issue of the case of Eric Garner, the suit up in New York City. What have you found out about that? What's the present status of that particular suit, Eric Garner?
Well, Earl Garner, the lawsuit now is being filed. And the state of New York, you might say, mainly Staten Island, but the state of New York, they want to sell the civil lawsuit, out of court. And there are reasons for this. They don't want ongoing forward publicity. That's number one. The suitcase, $5 million. That's a lot of taxpayers' money. We don't know what the number going to be, but they don't want to go to court. They want to sell out of court. I don't know what the numbers would be. I can probably come up with some numbers. Most of the time you get 10 to 20% of what you're asking for at $75 million, so we're talking about basically $7.5 million to maybe $15 million. But I think there are six children involved. I think it's a wife involved, so it might be a little more than that. All these things are considered when you get to the numbers. But again, the taxpayers are paying for something, police negligence, police brutality, and they have to put a contingency. I don't think training is going to help. When certain things in your DNA, training doesn't help. This is an extension of slavery, brutality during slavery time, during the lawless West, when it happened. You know, it's just the way it is. We have to understand that. This is the DNA of America. We have to understand that. Police brutality is one of the things that's going to happen where we lack it. That's an ongoing problem. And slavery, brutality, hanging slaves, hunting slaves down, shooting them. There was no recourse. But now there's recourses now. But what they have done, they put same people in uniform, put badges on them. They're not doing background checks on these people. Most of them, again, the resume doesn't quite look favorable. They really don't care. They want people that will shoot first, that they can protect to a certain degree. They're not for your protection as much as they're for their own protection. They're not for your protection. They're going to make sure that the law has a way of understanding. And the understanding is to shoot first, ask questions later. Ask one police officer, what were they training when he shoot a person? They shoot for the heart, the second place is for the heart they shoot for. They don't try to wound in the body or that type of thing. That's not how they train. So again, training. That's not going to help much when your DNA is totally something different. It's just the way it is. We have to understand that. But the Garner case, another would be, again, injustice. Now we're going to see if we can get justice, can get monetary justice for it, which is no minimal monetary justice. They would love to have their father there. These kids got to grow up without a father. And that is not the thing. But again, loose cigarettes. You kill a person over loose cigarettes. It's amazing to me what we shoot people over. Things we have shot people over in this country day after day. Children, people who are very lawful, they still get shot. The law sometimes is lawlessness, and we have to understand that. Understand what's going on. That uniform don't make them a good person. Inside of the DNA is inside of them. They come out of a family that was destructive. They have a long a family history of destruction, whether it be the second, third, fourth, fifth generation. It's who they are. I understand the DNA of most of the police officers that we have. The resume is a father, it's an uncle, it's a cousin, it's all nepotism because they love the benefits. They can kill and don't get prosecuted for it. Something they've been doing all along. Didn't get prosecuted in the 1800s or 1700s, didn't get prosecuted for it. And early 1900s, the legend and everything else, didn't get prosecuted for it. So it's the same thing. Just a little bit different, that's all. A little bit different, but it's the same. Nothing, it's the same. It's disguised again, the DNA.
You know, Emmanuel, we're going to make a transition to a subject matter that is one that need to be known by the majority of the people in America, but they know very little. But at the same time, there is information in the newspapers for the last couple of days about the possibility of Obama is planning on trying to create the condition to normalize relationship with Cuba. And it was a great thing that just took place a couple of days ago where they had an exchange of prisoners. The rest of the members of the Cuban Five, three Cuban freedom fighters and brothers from Cuba, they was given their release and they had returned home. And there was a spy that U.S. placed great value for. His name was Rolando Sharif Trujillo. He was released from Cuba prison and shipped to America along with 53 other prisoners and another spy, Alan Gross, who was incarcerated in Cuba for over 5 years. So they had a swap of prisoners. And the whole world was glad to see that there's a great prospect on normalized relationship between the various two countries. You know, Cuba's only 90 miles away from the U.S. And each country has so much they could give to each other and make humanity better. I would just like to know, based on your understanding, what is your general thought on that possibility and why you think it would benefit both peoples to go ahead and normalize and have a healthy relationship between the two countries?
Well, that is this is 50 years in the, you might say, 50 years it's been going on. The diplomatic opening toward Cuba, it's going to be a long road ahead to do that. First, there's got to be some congressional things that's got to be approved. We need an ambassadorship, funding, all this has to happen. The Republicans, of course, what has been going on for 50 years has not worked. So now I think it's time to normalize relationship. It's probably a good idea. I think so. There are some things that we got to look in the rearview mirror at, and we got to sort of do something with that. You talked about the prisoner exchange. That's been going on for about 18 months or more. Between, of course, that particular time was John Kerry, of course, and Mrs. Clinton. So that was something that was, I said, being discussed over 18 months ago about that, about the exchange. And we have to understand that these relationships are not going to be that normal. Because at one time they said they will never make the exchange for gross freedom in exchange for the return of three Cuban spies. But like I say, that happened. So that shows a deep concern of a sickness in there. But again, we have to look at what the Republican Party, who controls the House, the purse strings in Congress. So a lot of things they could do to, might say, sort of shut down portions of the government, of the diplomatic openings to Cuba. So when you look at that, they have a section of the Congress, and this section of the Congress people don't know too much about, and it's called the U.S. Interest Section. So that held the funding, basically, of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And you got to look at who is the person that held most of this, the funding, and things they can do, not to shut it down, but also to hinder. So what has to happen now that the Foreign Relations Committee got to look at some of the sanctions against Cuba and make things happen a little bit more friendlier? I believe that corporations in America, I think most of the people in America, would lock these relationships because you can use the master charge and Visa and all these charge cards. They would love that because, again, they can use those particular charge cards to allow U.S. credit and debit cards in Cuba. But does it violate sections of the law? We don't know yet. So we have to look at the HAMS and Burden Act that controls the credit system and the debit card system in the United States. So we got to look at, take this, like I said, it's going to be a long journey ahead, and we look at how it's going to play out in Congress. So the annual funding bills for the federal agency and other oversight actions could occur. In the House of Representatives. So again, we got to look and see who the negative opponents are, and they're mainly going to be Republicans. But again, corporations like General Motors, I would say the cruise lines, airlines, hospitality, hotel, this type of thing, the Marriott, things like this to build hotels there and everything else. It would be a place to people would love to go because, again, what happened during these 50 years of being controlled by the military, and the military still controlled the economy of Cuba now. So now we got to, how are we going to handle that? John Deere will be happy, infrastructure. They would love that, going in and do a lot of building, redoing again. For the cars in Cuba, they are real, real old cars. Most of them are, 16, 20, 30-year-old cars. General Motors would love to put new cars up in there and put a plant up in there probably. Got great workers there. So, again, this is a long journey. We're going to play this out. as it get played out. Again, you're talking about a communistic country, dictatorship, but again, it's run by the military, by our family, Castro's. So we're going to have to look at this very clear, see how much diplomacy we can put in, democratic ways we can put in, and making a viable economy. There are some great things to be done in Cuba.
Okay.
And again, I am for it totally. I think this is wrong, overdue, thanks to President Obama, to open up relationship with Cuba. We have a relationship with the largest communist country, which is China. So I can't see why we have a little small country like Cuba to not to have normal relationship with.
Okay, I'll stop you like right there, Emmanuel, and let our listen audience know that y'all listen to Listen Page of History. Emmanuel is giving his views and perspectives on various current events. We'd like now welcome our listening audience to call in and share your views and your perspectives on the very current events that we have discussed and maybe others. Today, this evening, we've been discussing witnesses and the grand jury process and how they're playing out in Ferguson, along with the upcoming lawsuit of Eric Garner, and what y'all think about Cuba and U.S. relations and this question of possible normalizing. So what we want to do, we're going to let our listening audience know that we're going to be going over a few minutes, so if you don't get to hear the entirety of the program, please go to our archive by typing on the link www.blogtalkradio.com/ and you type in the word missing-pages-of-history-inc. And you view this program and all of our archive programs that have been produced so far. And we can open up our phone lines. If you have any views or comments, please hit 1. And we will acknowledge your last 4 numbers of your phone. And before I do this, we also would like to congratulate our last week quarterly fundraising raffle ticket winners who supported Mr. Page's History. And we ended our last quarterly raffle winners contest for the year 2014. And with that ending of that raffle drawing for this year, we'd like to congratulate Ray Robinson for winning first prize. We'd like to congratulate Lewis Wolf for winning third prize. And we'd like to congratulate Shirley Grantley for winning second prize. Those were the winners of our last raffle drawing fundraiser for this year. And our next one will take place in 2015, February 21st. So we'll keep you more informed. For more information, you always can call us at 804-726-3217. So we're going back to our listening audience. We have quite a few people been waiting for a while patiently. We'll call off your last 4 numbers, and based on the topics and views that have been articulated this evening, we would like for you to share yours with us. And let's continue filling out missing pages of history. Our first caller, we'll take caller 6029. Caller 6029, welcome to Missing Pages of History. Your question, comments for today.
Yes, I'd just like to respond to your guest. Let me just correct some distortions that your guest laid out there. First, it's important that people understand that the Cuban Five were not spies. They were here to monitor subversives who were dedicated to destruction of Cuba. It had nothing to do in terms of U.S. policy. So let's get that off the table right away so people understand that they weren't spies, that their incarceration was a political act by the United States government. Secondly, the Cuban government is not controlled by the military. It's controlled by the Communist Party. And the Communist Party has the right to run its government as it sees fit under U.N. international law. There's a notion that somehow Cuba has to be a reflection of U.S. government is crazy. Cuba has a right to be autonomous, to be independent, to in fact determine what its policy should be. How they go about electing its representatives is strictly Cuba's business and nobody else's. So U.S. will have no right in terms of dictating to Cuba how it should run its government or how the government should be set up. And lastly, I think just in terms of when we talk about freedoms, Cuba is more free than America. To the extent that people are free to participate, in the government is much more possible in Cuba as it is America. The American political system is rigged, and so therefore we understand the role of money in terms of whether or not determining who can participate in the system, who doesn't. So when we talk about just in sheer numbers, then we talk about participation, Cuba is more democratic than America. So I just want to say that and conclude with that, and thank you for your time.
All right, Carly, thank you for your perspective. We next go to our next caller online. They've been waiting so patiently. We thank you, caller. Caller, you 3330. Your question or comment, please. 3330, caller. Welcome.
I'd like to make a comment in regards to the Cuban decision. I'm looking forward to the positivity that can come for it because for people of color, Cuba has been very important in terms of offering medical aid, as well as helping to fight against apartheid and other ills that have affected Africa, the homeland of people of color. So I look forward to the positivity that can bring us getting connected with our extended family. Thank you.
Thank you, caller, for your comments and views. We next will go to our caller. We'll go to caller 4298. Caller 4298, your question or comment, please. And thank you for your patience and waiting. Yes, caller 4298.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, caller.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
can
we can,
me?
Caller. Yes.
Okay. The struggle against capitalism or the profit before people's needs drive is a protracted, long struggle that won't end during our lifetimes. The needs of the many are more important than the needs of the few. The few are comfortable with the social order because their needs are being satisfied for the most part. The role of fascism is to crush the life and spirit out of the vanguard of the working class, a.k.a. the communists. Fascism and fascism are related. It's all about words and deeds. That struggle continues from Ferguson to Palestine.
Okay, caller, thank you for your views and comments. And our last caller we have been waiting for a while. Caller, we'd like to thank you for your patience. Caller, your number is 9289. Caller 9289. Welcome to Missing Pages of History. Your question or comment, please.
Yeah, I think it's nice that President Obama decided to finally make a change with the Cuban government. And on top of it, I think the one thing that he needs to do, if he would really reconsider using his power to make the embargo end now, because he can override and don't have to wait for the legislatures to actually vote on that.
That's interesting you say that, caller, and I'm going to address this question to Emmanuel. Emmanuel, the caller raised an issue that we can see is taking place now in Congress about the power between the presidency and the Congress. And the president does have executive orders that he can issue that can create conditions that things can become more favorable between the relationship. What you think about the president having the right to use his executive laws into being, and since he's given the right of their power, how you feel about this attitude that the Congress has been taking towards him when he applied to use that particular procedure, and they become very hostile towards him using, whereas other presidents who have done that, they never treated them in that fashion when they made executive orders. How you feel about this whole process of the president using his executive orders and how he's been dealt with?
Fine, everything I've said has been totally true. I understand some people, you know, don't like the truth. Upset sometimes. But again, your question about the executive power, there's three branches of government, legislative, judicial, and executive. And the executive power, there are some things he cannot. He can't go but so far again. But again, when it comes to the purse strings or people who write in the check, that is from the House. The House controls the funding. Very simple. So a lot of things he's doing, allocating money, allocating this type of thing, he cannot do that but so far. And again, he has lawyers around him to make sure that he don't overreach his executive power. So, but again, when you lose, the Republicans lost the general election. So you're going to see this opposition when you lose. And again, he's doing things for the American people. He's doing things for the world. He's the chief executive of the world, you might say. He's the most powerful man in the world today. That's a living creature that's talking and breathing. So when you look at that, you're going to find that. When you lose, these things happen. Hate is in the world. We have to understand the capitalist system. And the system is rigged. It's been rigged. It's going to stay rigged. Been rigged since biblical days. It's going to stay rigged. So we can't unrig it. All countries basically have a rigged system. The poor and there's the rich. There's no in between. The middle class is just there. People that probably call in, they're probably the middle class. They got a job and everything. They like the system. They like the capitalist system because they don't have a job. They don't have one. They will not have a job. So understand the system, how it works. The blueprint is out there. You just make sure you get equal protection under the law. And when you use the word equal, make sure you include it in the word equal. Well, from the beginning, you was a piece of property, a chattel. But now you're not a piece of property anymore. You're a human being. Human rights all over the world. So understand that. And again, when you see certain things happen, one gentleman called about the military still runs Cuba. He can say what he wants to say. I know. You see them when they come on, they got military uniforms on. I don't see no one dressed like they're supposed to be dressed other than the uniforms on. They're not run by the communist. The communist goes to get a gene, but still military. Russia has the same thing. Who runs Russia? The military, basically. Again, communists are run by military people, basically. So, again, we ran by the military from the beginning. George Washington got it out of his hands. Eisenhower was the last military person who ran our country, basically. There was a retired military soldier, may say a general. So look at everything from this point of view, that this was a great thing. President Obama, that was a brave decision. And again, it's a long journey of road ahead, like I say. There's oppression in Cuba like everywhere else. There's oppression here like everywhere else. You got to oppress someone to be rich. They are rich Cubans, they are poor Cubans. They are black Cubans, they are mulatto Cubans. And they are white Cubans, you might say. And all of them have, there's a caste system in Cuba also. People who have been there, they can tell you that. There's racism there like everywhere else. So they're not disdaining themselves from racism. It's there also. We can't straighten all this up because the system is rigged. It's going to stay rigged. Kept what we do. Elizabeth Warren said the system is rigged. I say it's rigged. I've been saying it was rigged before she said it. I grew up 9, 10 years old. I knew it was rigged. So the whole understanding is understand the system, the systemic things in the system. Understand it. And we as black people really have to understand it because we came from a system of slavery, which you had no rights. But now you have rights. We just got to use the blueprint that has been written. We have to exhaust the blueprint as far as we can. And that's what the Earl Garner team's doing. They suing the police department. One time you couldn't do that. You couldn't do that at all. But now you can do that. So these are the kind of things we've got to look at the system. All we have to do is attack it. That's what President Obama does. He looks at the system. He didn't see it. He noticed he's a constitutional lawyer. Who knows it better than he knows it? And he dispels ignorance. That's why he don't raise hell with them or enrage to get angry. He just keeps doing what he's doing. Executive powers as much as he can. It's called executive power. He's using the power of the executive branch and taking it to its full extent. He's not overreaching because he knows the confines of this particular executive power and is rendering. He's doing everything right as he possibly can as president. The other two branches are looking at him and trying to basically disrupt him as much as they possibly can. To be a lame duck president, he's doing a fantastic job. We need to look more into what things he has accomplished. He has accomplished more than any president in recent years, and any president. Spoken on things that other presidents wouldn't even speak on, or they would totally lie about. He don't have a lying vice president. Biden is a very good vice president. He don't tell lies like Dick Cheney. So understand his presidency. It's not a lying presidency. It's not a lying presidency at all. He comes straight forward, and he makes a lot of sense. So understand the system. He understands it. I understand it. Some people are so radical, they don't want to understand it. Understand what's in front of you. Understand it. It's all written there. All we have to do is understand it.
Emmanuel, I'd like to get your take. We only have a few minutes left. But I'd like to get your take on this program that the police departments have in place, where they are now giving state troopers and policemen some money to hand out to civilians while they're riding down the highway as a Christmas present. Mm. What is your general take on that? What is that all about? And
I have two issues
I'd like to raise within that context. Number one, where the money is coming from, and number two, how is that any different from transferring money from the government to its citizens under the so-called concept of welfare? Is that also a form of welfare, taking tax money from the collective and giving to those who are in need? But I find it to be real ironic of that program. So I'm just curious if you might know of anything about where the money is coming from, number one. Number two, are they getting that money out to the people on the road equally based upon race? And number three, is there any check and balance to prove that they did give the money out when it was given the money to be given out? It also led to the possibility of corruption. And they've been showing these little propaganda pieces on the television for the last 3-4 days on the news. So I'd like to just hear your take on it. Because I don't hear no outcry about they giving money out. And then when people need money in the society, you know, you have a certain sector of people saying they shouldn't be giving anything. So I'm just curious in terms of that phenomenon. What is your take on that?
I don't have much take on that because, again, I don't know too much about that. Some of the news I disfavor a lot. Giving during the Christmas time is a giving factor from all over. I mean, it just happens from churches to different organizations. They give money out. Police departments give money out. The veterans do the same. So it's a lot involved there. I don't think there is no corruption, I think, involved, none of that type of thing. There could be their own money. People do that also. But like I said, I haven't really no take on that. I just don't want to even deal with that in a sense because, again, money is given so many different ways during Christmas time and during other times also. There's so much, there's $370 billion of charitable money being donated, you know, around the country. That's in America by itself, not even count outside America. So that's a lot of money. $370 billion is a lot of money. That would it cost to run this country for 1 month, approximately 1 month to run this country, about $370 billion. So that's 1 month, you might say, given to charity to this country equal to what the United States spends on this budget for 1 month, you know, financing this country, things that we do. So a lot of money. And how they give it away and ways they give it away, that's up to how they do it. Again, with as long as it's legal to a certain point, that you're not to try and influence anything of that nature, that's fine. It's not propagandist at all. It's just giving away money to people of need, or maybe people who don't need necessarily, or people who have just want to do it regardless. I've seen that happen over many years, that people who had, say, well-off in the community, they would give money to people, $10, $20, you know, along, and just do that, meet them at a certain place or town hall, that type of thing, and give
this
everybody $20.
This giveaway is $100 envelope. But
yeah,
anyway,
$100. That's a normal thing that I get you to do the same thing also. So I have really no take on that. That's, again, that is a giver program. It's not a form of welfare, this or that. I think it's just giving during the Christmas time spirit. I've seen it happen a lot, so. But it's not a, you know, I don't think it's anything we can be concerned with.
Okay, Emmanuel, we have ran out of time. We'd like to thank our listening audience for allowing us to come to home this evening. Remember, this is a bi-weekly program. You can hear us every Saturday at 12 o'clock, 12 noon sharp. As we continue to try to fill in the missing pages of history, we'd like to wish everybody